Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Happy holidays. Welcome to December's podcast. We are very excited for this month's podcast, especially since we have a special treat for our listeners. Right, Lena?
Yep, that's right. At the end of the podcast, we'll announce what holiday shenanigans we have in store.
Now let's get started so we can let our listeners know what they can expect for the holiday season. For this podcast, we'll be reviewing CME articles on adhesive capsulitis and resistant hypertension.
And we will also take a look at reevaluation of race in the estimated GFR calculation and a case report on implementation of a ketogenic diet on a breastfeeding woman.
And as always, a quick reminder that after listening to this month's podcast, go to cme.aapa.org and take the CME post test. It's at the bottom of the page. And when you score at least a 70%, you earn a Category 1 CME.
Yep. And lastly, for a quick disclaimer, this podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take, our opinions, which do not represent JAPA, the authors, the publisher, or the editors. This is not intended as medical advice. For our first article, we're going to be reviewing Understanding Resistant Hypertension. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. To start us off, the authors gave us a patient case to keep in mind as we review this article. Spoiler alert, this patient has several factors which are contributing to his hypertension. But in brief, he's a 62-year-old obese white male with significant past medical history for hypertension times 20 years and obstructive sleep apnea. He presented to the office with the chief complaint of high home BP readings. He states his systolic blood pressure is usually around 160 to 170s for the last 3 months. His current blood pressure regimen includes amlodipine, navitolol, and hydrochlorothiazide. And as previously mentioned, he was diagnosed with hypertension 20 years ago and states despite multiple changes in his blood pressure regimen, his systolic blood pressure readings have consistently remained above 150. And as for lifestyle modification, he admits to inconsistency with healthy low-sodium diet and exercise, but states that he is compliant with his CPAP machine at night. During his visit, his blood pressure was 190 over 95 in the right arm and 195 over 95 in the left arm. And his average ambulatory 24-hour blood pressure reading was about 175 over 90. His physical exam was mostly benign with no signs of end organ damage, so no concerns for hypertension emergency. At the end of his visit, he was diagnosed with resistant hypertension and was started on spironolactone, counseled on lifestyle modifications, and referred to a hypertension specialist. Brandon, before we go any further, any thoughts on how you would manage this patient's blood pressure?
Just trying to recall, like, just first line for outpatient. I think it's like a diuretic, like HCTZ, and then an ACE and ARB. And then you go to your calcium channel blockers and then beta blockers if necessary. But what's been most effective for me that I've seen with patients, especially with patients coming to hospital with crazy high hypertension. We either first give them try labetalol, give them 10 of labetalol. And then if that doesn't work, then the next thing is hydralazine.
I love hydralazine.
Yeah, I remember, don't you remember, like, the farm, I remember, it's funny how, like, your teachers and, I guess, your preceptors influence you so much. I remember our farm teacher was like, stay away from hydralazine, like, no matter what, like, it's a bad drug. But everyone uses it, and it works, like, I've seen nothing, but it does what it's supposed to do. Like, if someone's having, in a hypertensive emergency, The hydralazine, 9 out of 10 times, is going to get the job done.
Yeah. I mean, I always go low and slow with it, because I don't want to drop my patients.
Yeah, what do you give, like 10 or 5?
I give 5, and then I start there, five. And then add more.
I always did 5, and then I did that, and the attending was like, that's not doing anything. Like, you're wasting your time just doing that. I'm like, hey, it doesn't hurt to give them that, and then you can always give them a 5 later, but I guess that's just the process of us being in the game for a year. And
I know. I mean, if they're older, I'm like, you're going to get 5.
Yeah.
But in this case, I would also, like I mentioned, ACE inhibitor or an ARB, which I'm surprised he wasn't on already. But I would also evaluate him for renal artery stenosis, like with a renal angiogram or like an ultrasound or something, just to rule that out as maybe a cause for his persistent high blood pressure. Obviously, of course, lifestyle modifications would definitely give him some benefit, but considering that he's on all of these medications and has been for the last 20 years with minimal improvement, I'm wondering if there's some other causes going on in the background there. But yeah, we're going to move on. We're going to define resistant hypertension. The American College of Cardiology defines resistant hypertension as blood pressure readings greater than 130 over 80 with three or more antihypertensive medications of different classes, and one of these classes must be a diuretic, or a patient with controlled high blood pressure with four or more antihypertensives. The American Heart Association also defines resistant hypertension similarly. However, a diuretic is not a requirement. Quick side note, this definition was recently changed in 2017, as before they used the blood pressure reading of 140 over 80 as the mark. Moving on to epidemiology, 17% of the U.S. population has resistant hypertension by this new definition. Some modifiable risk factors are diabetes, obesity, and a sedentary lifestyle. Non-modifiable risk factors are Black ethnicity, older age, male sex, and modulation of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system in response to high-sodium diet, which we'll discuss further later. Though the prevalence of hypertension has decreased, the prevalence of resistant hypertension has not. And in fact, it actually has increased. And unfortunately, the sequelae from resistant hypertension is end organ damage, which can cause retinopathy, left ventricular hypertrophy, heart failure, myocardial infarction, CVA, CKD, and unfortunately, death. Which is why it's important to note these, as patients have a 47% greater risk of experiencing these outcomes with resistant hypertension. So quick pathophysiology. The mainstay of managing high blood pressure is maintaining a balance between fluid retention and urinary output, as elevated blood pressure occurs from the increased reabsorption of sodium and water driven by the RAS system. So speaking of the RAS system, here's a quick refresher. In the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, renin is released, activating angiotensinogen, which then turns into angiotensin 1. And that turns into angiotensin 2 via ACE, which is angiotensin-converting enzyme. Angiotensin 2 then causes vasoconstriction, directly increasing blood pressure, and triggers the renal tubules to increase sodium and water reabsorption, increasing volume, which thus increases blood pressure. Plus, it stimulates aldosterone synthesis from the adrenal cortex, which means more sodium and water reabsorption in exchange for potassium. The RAS system is activated by four triggers: renal baroreceptors that notice changes in renal perfusion pressure, sympathetic nerve stimulation via beta adrenergic receptors, negative feedback by angiotensin 2 on juxtaglomerular cells, and changes in delivery of sodium chloride to the distal tubules, thus increasing serum sodium. This increase in serum sodium attracts increased fluid retention as water follows sodium, simple chemistry, but this leads to elevated blood volume and arterial pressure, which again leads to elevated blood pressure. However, once this increased serum sodium is excreted, water follows, reducing blood volume and arterial pressure, thus decreasing blood pressure, which occurs when the RAS system is down-regulated. Increased sodium intake also has a similar effect on blood pressure as it leads to water retention and increased blood volume. However, evidence has shown that some patients are non-modulators, like I mentioned earlier. This means that they have a limited ability to regulate the RAS system in response to hypernatremia. This leads to even more serum sodium and fluid retention, and as mentioned before, this non-modulatory response is a non-modifiable risk factor for resistant hypertension. For clinical presentation, it's not uncommon for patients to be asymptomatic with resistant hypertension. However, they are at risk for hypertensive urgency and emergency. And a quick refresher on those two. Hypertensive urgency is a systolic blood pressure greater than 180 or diastolic blood pressure greater than 120 without signs or symptoms of end organ damage. Hypertensive emergency has the same blood pressure requirements, but end organ damage has occurred. This is usually presenting as severe retinopathy, acute kidney injury, acute coronary syndrome with elevated troponin, or seizures. So now that we've defined resistant hypertension, we talked about the pathophysiology, but what are some physical exam findings or diagnostic tests that lead us to this diagnosis and help us identify the extent of our patient's resistant hypertension? Our first step, no brainer, but obtain an accurate blood pressure reading. The American Heart Association actually recommends using an automatic blood pressure machine versus manual auscultation just to keep things standardized, which I was surprised by. Additionally, you want to ensure your patient is relaxed, sitting upright with legs uncrossed, and an empty urinary bladder, which is new news to me. But if your patient has consumed caffeine, or if they've exercised or smoked within 30 minutes to their visit, this can affect their reading as well. And of course, you always want to obtain a measurement in both arms. The gold standard, though, for obtaining a blood pressure is a 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. This gives us a better accurate picture of our patient's blood pressure, as sometimes this could be affected by white coat syndrome or some of the factors I mentioned earlier. Additionally, some baseline tests you should obtain are a urine analysis, fasting blood glucose, hemoglobin A1C, lipid levels, a CBC, CMP, estimated GFR, TSH, and an EKG. And on exam, you want to include a fundoscopic exam and thorough auscultation for Bruis. Brandon, for our PA students listening out there, what are Bruis?
Bruis, those are like just abnormal sounds of, I guess, turbulent, mm-hmm. turbulent blood flow through a artery.
Caused by?
Due to like some type of obstruction.
Yes. Beautiful. And all of this is just to basically assess for end organ damage or any causes for secondary hypertension. And speaking of secondary hypertension, the article has a lovely chart that lists out the most common causes of secondary hypertension, their clinical presentations, and their diagnostic tests. This is super important as secondary hypertension causes 5 to 10% of cases of resistant hypertension. And OSA is the most common cause, as 70% of patients with resistant hypertension have OSA. Renal artery stenosis is another cause, as well as medications such as NSAIDs, oral contraceptives, corticosteroids, tricyclic antidepressants, and let's not forget about psychological stressors and drug use like cocaine, amphetamines, and alcohol. For management, you want to talk to your patient about non-pharmacological methods as well as pharmacological methods. Mainstay for non-pharmacological methods are just lifestyle modification. Diet, the DASH diet, which stands for the Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension. This has proven to reduce systolic blood pressure by 11 points. So it's important to educate your patients on a low-saturated, trans-fat diet and low-sodium diet, 1,500 milligrams per day max, and even refer them to a nutritionist. Remember, sodium reduction is crucial, especially for those who are non-modulators. Use those motivational interviewing skills to encourage cessation of smoking, drug use, and increased alcohol consumption. Also educate patients on the importance of exercising 90 to 50 minutes per week and to encourage weight loss. For pharmacological methods, remember, resistant hypertension means your patient is on at least 3 antihypertensive medications, which these should include an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, calcium channel blocker, and a diuretic. If your patient's estimated GFR is greater than 30, you want to give them a thiazide. If they have CHF, you want to give them a loop diuretic to help with volume overload. If your patient is on the max dose of all three medications, a mineral corticoid receptor antagonist can be introduced. In this case, spironolactone, which we talked about in our patient earlier. However, direct vasodilators can also be used, such as hydralazine or minoxidil, and other drug classes can include centrally acting alpha agonists, such as clonidine. Just remember, you have to taper your patients off this slowly, or they'll have rebound hypertension. Lastly, vasodilating beta blockers can be helpful as well, such as labetalol, carvedilol, or navetalol. And lastly, refer your patient to a hypertension specialist and be sure to rule out any secondary causes of hypertension. And a quick fun fact, renal denervation has been shown to reduce blood pressure in patients with essential hypertension only. And this procedure is awaiting FDA approval, according to this article. But it may soon be an option for patients as well. Brandon, what are your thoughts?
For this article, I thought that it was another very important topic, something that I see frequently. You see, especially at nighttime, get a lot of calls of, oh, patient's blood pressure is still like 170 and they receive boom, 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 boom. They received everything, like what to do next. So it's good to have like just to refresh yourself on the guidelines on what to use, and important to know like what to do inpatient and what to do outpatient. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it seems like it's most accepted to do one of, like you said, the vasodilating beta blockers, the direct vasodilators like the hydralazine. Mm-hmm. In the acute setting, but chronically you don't ever see labetalol or hydralazine isn't the first medication you're going to put them on. So it's just, I guess it's important to just constantly remind yourself of what to use in the acute setting and then what to use in the chronic setting.
Agreed.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Lena. The next article is titled Adhesive Capsulitis, a Review for Clinicians. So what is adhesive capsulitis? We may have heard it referred to as frozen shoulder, but it is an inflammatory process where patients experience decreased range of motion as well as an increase of pain in the shoulder joint. And the inflammation that causes this can either be idiopathic, but it's typically due to a small tissue injury from a recent surgery or minor injury. And due to the inflammatory process, the glenohumeral joint begins to experience prolific fibroblastic proliferation and extensive scar tissue development, which leads to this decreased range of motion and pain. We know the shoulder to be the joint in the body to have the largest range of motion, and as these factors build up, a patient is unable to maneuver the shoulder with both active and passive range of motion. The course of the disease is broken up into three parts: the freezing stage, the frozen stage, and the thawing stage. During the freezing stage, there is a progressive worsening for the patient, and the patient may begin to feel that the shoulder is stiff as well as start to experience gradual loss of range of motion. And during this stage, that is when there is a thickening of the soft tissue. During the frozen process, this is when the shoulder has reached a pinnacle stiffness and there is complete loss of both active and passive range of motion. Depending on when the patient presents to you, that will determine the level of pain and the decreased range of motion that they may be experienced at the time. However, most patients will have a decrease in range of motion in at least two planes compared to the unaffected shoulder. And then during the thawing stage, the patient begins to gain their range of motion back. And this is typically with the assistance of both physical therapy in combination with the use of anti-inflammatories. So why does this occur? There are a number of risk factors that may lead to adhesive capsulitis, and some of the main ones noted were diabetes, hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, and hypoadrenalism. And one of the interesting numbers that I came across in the article was those who have a fasting glucose of 85 and below were significantly less likely to be associated with adhesive capsulitis, and those with a fasting glucose above 90 was the complete opposite. A common theme that has resurfaced time and time again is how chronic illnesses such as hypertension and diabetes seem to affect every single thing. I would not have thought that diabetes would have an effect on this, or maybe hypothyroidism, but just the idea of diabetes dealing with something, a more, I guess, orthopedic type of injury was very surprising. As previously stated, those who've had injuries to the upper extremities, such as a rotator cuff and bicep tendon tears, will be people who are likely to experience frozen shoulder. And also postmenopausal women, and also men and women between the ages of 60 and 40, are those typically affected. So how do we go about diagnosing this? With physical exam, it would be very telling if the patient has a decreased range of motion in both active and passive, as well as gradual worsening of symptoms. However, x-rays can be used to help rule out calcific tendonitis, and an MRI can be used to evaluate the soft tissue for tendonitis and other tears, which can also be the reason for mechanical blocks. Also, the MRI will show capsular thickening, synovial hypertrophy, and hyperintensity of the capsule and the synovium. So how to treat it? The mainstay for treatment for adhesive capsulitis is physical therapy and anti-inflammatories such as NSAIDs and corticosteroid injections. Early and frequent movement has a significant impact in terms of patient recovery from an injury, as opposed to limiting motion and resting the joint in the acute stages of that injury. If you don't use it, you lose it. Another intervention that may be used is PRP, or platelet-rich plasma. And this is a concentration of the patient's platelet into the area that is affected, in this case the shoulder. And in theory, this will accelerate the healing process of soft tissue. And the one ironic thing about that is that one of my clients that I actually train actually was suffering from plantar fasciitis and received, I think, maybe two or three injections of PRP. And then weeks later, I would say maybe 2 to 3 weeks later, she began to experience a significant decrease in pain, and she's been able to do exercises and maneuver at her baseline. So it was something that was new, that was brought to my attention, that I wasn't aware of. Lena, are you familiar with PRP, or have you heard anyone who has used PRP?
No, but it makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. When I heard of it, I was like, okay, this sounds like something that's would be, I guess, not accessible. It seemed like, oh, something that like pro athletes would get, things like that. But yeah, I guess everyday normal citizens are getting it as well. And then lastly, there are some instances where surgery may be required where physical therapy and anti-inflammatories are not effective. However, this is not common, as one study revealed that close to 90% of patients had a full recovery with the use of non-surgical interventions. The surgical interventions refer to manipulation under anesthesia, so essentially doing what would be done during a physical therapy session, but more intensely in hopes of breaking up the soft tissue. And another surgical intervention would be where they use arthroscopic capsular release, and that's where they go in and cut around the scar tissue surrounding the glenohumeral joint. And in conclusion, like any other condition, surgery should be last line and non-invasive measures should be taken first. And with physical therapy and corticosteroid injections being the mainstay of treatment, for the most part, this disease is self-limiting. However, this condition is extremely painful for patients, so clinicians must remain empathetic and diligent in encouraging PT and recommending surgery if indeed indicated.
Thank you for that, Brandon. I'm kind of surprised how you mentioned earlier diabetes, hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism. Adhesive capsulitis is more common in patients with these comorbidities.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to know more about the mechanism. I guess all the inflammation that they cause.
Just your body isn't able to just heal and rebound as it once was when in its, I guess, healthy state.
Well, moving on, we have a case report titled Metabolic Acidosis in a Lactating Woman Induced by a Deliberate Ketogenic Diet. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. A 27-year-old female presented with ED with a chief complaint of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and postural dizziness for 4 days. She states that her symptoms are provoked by eating and drinking more than a few sips of water. She also admitted to a frontal headache that did not improve with her prescribed Furoset and denied any fevers, chills, abdominal or back pain, as well as any shortness of breath, chest pain, seizures, or loss of consciousness. History significant for a recent C-section 4 months ago and has since been breastfeeding her newborn and her 2-year-old child. She has also noticed a decrease in her breast milk production. She states that she has been implementing a ketogenic diet over the last 2 months, resulting in a 35-pound weight loss. Vital signs are overall stable, however, her blood pressure is borderline hypotensive, 111 over 71, and her heart rate is 96 beats per minute. Temperature, SpO2, all within normal limits. On physical exam, she had notable dry mucous membranes with mild epigastric and left upper quadrant tenderness. However, her abdomen was otherwise soft and non-distended on exam. Her notable labs were sodium of 131, potassium of 5.3, her carbon dioxide was 8, alkphos 162, lipase was 1,040, magnesium was 2.3, phosphorus was less than 0.5, and her urine analysis was notable for bilirubin, ketones, proteins, and red blood cells, and also her hemoglobin, hematocrit were also elevated. Her urine HCG was negative. EKG was notable for sinus tachycardia with a heart rate of 114 beats per minute. CT abdomen and pelvis was notable for mild hepatic steatosis without any significant inflammation or other findings. For management, while she was in the ED, she received a 1-liter fluid bolus as well as an antiemetic and 25 milligrams of IV diphenhydramine to manage her dehydration and nausea. And she additionally received another liter bolus of IV lactate at Ringer. She was then admitted to the ICU and received D5W with 150 milliliters of sodium bicarb per liter and was started on a clear liquid diet. Additionally, she was started on an oral and IV potassium and phosphorus before being transferred out of the ICU. And then she was discharged home on day 4 for hospitalization in stable condition. As we all know, a ketogenic diet includes a low-carb, high-fat, and protein diet, leading to early satiety and gluconeogenesis, breaking down the glycogen stored in the liver. Once the storage is depleted, the body breaks down fat into ketone bodies for energy. This utilization and breakdown of fat leads to weight loss. However, initial weight loss is due to water excretion from depletion of glycogen. In our patient case, this is likely the cause of her elevated hemoglobin and hematocrit, as well as her postural hypotension and dizziness. Her other symptoms of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea are also common adverse reactions to ketogenic diets. They're also known as the keto flu. This can also contribute to her electrolyte imbalances. In this particular case, our patient was breastfeeding, which already requires women to increase their caloric intake by 600 to 700 points. And additionally, women who are breastfeeding, especially twins, have shown to have metabolic imbalances in ketoacidosis even without a ketogenic diet. Lastly, it's important to educate patients on the long-term effects of a ketogenic diet, which are hyperlipidemia and elevated triglyceride levels, which can lead to pancreatitis. This is something, you know, we all hear about ketogenic diets and how, especially for patients with diabetes, how they're really helpful, especially since it's low carb. But we also have to remember that patients with diabetes are also at increased risk for heart attack and stroke. So that's something to be mindful of. But Brandon, what are your thoughts on this article? I found it quite interesting because this is the first time I've really heard of any major adverse effects from a ketogenic diet. Granted, in this case, she was breastfeeding, which kind of probably accelerated this, but...
No, it's I found it interesting because I think with any diet, you just have to figure out what works for you. Be functional. It may be like easy for someone to do it, but keto diet, like, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, it's important for patients to consult with us before starting any diet. The article touched on this too. It's really important that, you know, especially women postpartum, obviously they've gained weight from carrying a child for 9 months, which they're supposed to, but sometimes society, you know, puts that pressure to lose weight, and especially quickly. In this case, she lost 35 pounds in 2 months. But that's why it's important to consult with us, especially with breastfeeding. You know, in this case, this is a time where you need to increase your caloric intake for a good reason. So I think it's important to just reinforce just having a balanced, healthy diet. Of course, if your patient needs to limit carbs, then absolutely need to. But I think it's important, especially for those in women's health or an OB-GYN, to just also have that discussion with your patients postpartum to take it slow steady when it comes anything. To losing weight.
It's like I always say, like, anything that's too easy, it's probably not true, or there are some pretty bad repercussions. So the next article that we'll be going over, title of the article was Reevaluating Race and the GFR Calculator. The basis of this article revealed how over time multiple equations have been used to evaluate patients for the development and progression of CKD. Over the years, there have been multiple factors which have led to inaccurate biases that may have been placed upon non-Hispanic blacks. Since 1999, GFR calculators have made the assumption that non-Hispanic blacks have increased muscle mass and therefore require an adjustment, which can lead to errors in dosing of the medication, the prevalence of the disease, and the assessment of the need of kidney transplants. The initial GFR calculator was developed in 1976 and called the Cockcroft-Gault calculator. However, this calculator was biased from the jump. The sample size of the population that was used to develop the calculator was made from 249 hospitalized white men. There weren't any women and no people of color, just white men. The next calculator that was used was the modification of diet renal disease, known as the MDRD, which was based on a study that included patients with known CKD, diabetic, non-diabetics, and black patients as well. The study used iothalamate, which is an exogenous filtration marker similar to inulin. The limitation of this study was the patients used already had CKD. It doesn't do a good job of accounting for those patients who have higher kidney functions. But the article essentially just talked about, there was a couple other calculators that have been developed using different markers, and just showing that over time, like, we still haven't gotten it right. The one that they use now that is recommended is called CKD Epi. Go to the articles and look to see which markers are used in that. It is, I guess, a promising thing to see that there has been recognition that the calculators have been biased. But I think that's kind of where America is now. What are we going to do now to fix it? Which is tough, because when things have been in place for so long, we're just like, okay, like, just why not keep it? Say it's not really hurting us. In this moment in time, and kind of forget about the other, like, people who are really rely on this. One of my coworkers was on dialysis, and she was talking about how, like, the GFR came into play of transplant and everything like that. So when I seen this article, I was like, oh yeah, we'll definitely have to go over this. I really appreciated this article from that fashion, but it just seems like how everything is very much the same. That we know that something is wrong, and then there are steps being made to correct it, but it's not perfect yet. But it's good to know that there is recognition, and there's a process in place, and constant, I guess, reevaluation that will hopefully get this thing right at some point in time.
Yeah, no. I was just talking to my students about this. We were talking about, we're doing an ethical debate, but it's kind of a little bit outdated, but how there's also just a disparity between black patients receiving a kidney transplant, as most kidney donors are white. And so just the HLA genes that they use to match up patients, donors, and recipients, there's already a little bit of a disparity there just from race alone, which they've kind of adjusted for that somewhat over the years. But also I talked about how there's also just the disparity of just being eligible for a kidney transplant because of the estimated GFR. And my students were asking, we're like, why do we still use it? What should we use now? And so now I can recommend maybe the CKD Epi. I wonder how many hospital systems or, you know, labs have the ability to calculate this frequently, and like insurance coverage and cost and all this other stuff.
And that was another thing that was taken into account, like cost, like what's the most effective but also the most cost effective. It's always I think, like, a tough situation of figuring out is based on, like, the way, like, we have to pay for it. Someone can see healthcare as a privilege. But I think it needs to be a balance of, like, it should be a right as well. Cost shouldn't matter in the terms of someone's life. But you really can't determine that in a capitalist society. Like, you gotta pay for everything somehow, some way. So that's tough. But they did mention that in the article, how cost of, because there are some, like, I guess, really, I guess, elite tests out there, but it's just not time effective or cost effective.
Maybe on the transplant side they can account for it somehow. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Brandon, for that review. We've come to the end of this month's podcast, but as promised, we do have a holiday treat for our listeners.
Yep, we have a bonus episode for this month, so stay tuned.
Yes, we're going to be reviewing about 4 abstract articles from December's edition, and we're going to share our opinions on them. So we hope that you will enjoy this bonus episode.
But before we go there, please be sure that you are following JAPA on social media. Their Instagram handle is @JAAPAonline. And under December's issue post, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input.
Yeah, you'll be hearing from us soon. Bye.